Hello, dear brothers and sisters of the Age of Enlightenment. Thank you all for coming here today. We have a very special event today. It's going a little bit out of our tradition, and we're doing a live event, bringing out the knowledge in its living value. So welcome to the full moon celebration for March 2017. Tonight, we will witness something very special, a Vedic debate, a Shastrartha, on the ultimate reality of life, on the eternal reality of infinite silence, infinite dynamism, and infinite bliss, which underlie all of creation, as anyone can verify through extended practice of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi's transcendental meditation and TM Siddhi programs, including yogic flying. As you know very well, these remarkable technologies of consciousness have been verified by more than 600 scientific studies to produce unprecedented benefits, total brain functioning, increased intelligence, development of the full potential of the individual, and they provide a practical technology to create permanent world peace and global invincibility, global Ram Raj, through group yogic flying. But extended group practice of yogic flying has given rise to a very unique level of experience, a level of experience which has been described by the sages and saints of the world throughout history as the ultimate reality of life, the ultimate truth of all existence, a reality of perfect bliss and infinite intelligence, and that yogic flyers have found to be their own self, and the self of everything, everywhere. It is very fulfilling to analyze that beautiful, extremely high level of experience intellectually, but tonight, we will do something more than that. We'll examine the very nature of this ultimate reality of life from two different angles. From the angle of duality, where there are two things, absolute and relative, or infinity and point, or silence and dynamism, or infinite peace and infinite power, at the basis of the universe, and from the angle of unity, where all there is one unbounded ocean of consciousness and motion, one perfect wholeness, and nothing else. Comparing these two angles of looking at the ultimate reality is the art of the ancient Vedic debate, Shastrartha, which Maharishi has introduced to us. With this, we will gain a greater insight into the ultimate reality. Maharishi's 1967 book on the Bhagavad Gita, Maharishi introduced to the world in the appendix of that book the six systems of Indian philosophy. The six systems present the criteria of true knowledge, the criteria by which knowledge can be evaluated for its profound truth. Each system provides its own criteria on knowledge, and Maharishi insists that all together are necessary for complete knowledge. In the same way that to really know what the table is, one must examine it from all sides, from the front and the back, from the left and the right, from the top and the bottom, and then one will really know what the table is. In the same way, the six systems of Indian philosophy examine the object of knowledge from six fundamentally different perspectives. All of them together offer the complete insight into truth. All of them are necessary components of true knowledge. Maharishi tells us that in the Vedic tradition, there is an age-old tradition of organizing public debates. In these debates, accomplished scholars of the different systems of Indian philosophy vie with one another in order to each uphold the integrity and truth of their own viewpoint on reality. The debate is a celebration of the completeness of Vedic knowledge. It provides an opportunity for the audience to see the contending perspectives on reality, drawing the audience out of the narrow confines of a naive, simplistic viewpoint, expanding their consciousness so that they become accustomed to see the truth from different perspectives, different angles. The audience is taken out of their comfort zone. Their fundamental beliefs are challenged, and the result? A broader, more accepting, more inclusive, more tolerant, more expanded consciousness. Now in our current political climate, the population is more polarized than ever before. divided between two opinions, two visions of government, two visions of the world, two futures, two political parties. In this heated and contentious atmosphere, where every day brings demonstrations and calls for action this way and that way, the ultimate flying club of MUM is applying the soothing balm of Vedic Shastrartha, Vedic debate, to help elevate the collective consciousness of society. Listen to this debate where the different components and perspectives of reality are held up for inspection. Is reality fundamentally unified, or is it fundamentally dual in nature? That is our theme tonight. Maharshi, as we said, supported and upheld the teachings of all the six systems of Indian philosophy as eternal knowledge, knowledge true for all time, for all mankind, in all places. Over the years, in different lectures, he brought out the salient points of each system of knowledge. Therefore, we cannot say that Maharshi said such and such, and therefore this perspective is true. Since Maharshi supported the truth of all the six systems, he cannot be presented as an authority whose word validates the platform of any one system over another. Therefore, our debaters tonight are not allowed to reference Maharshi in support of their theme. They must present the strength of their perspective on its own merits, with the validation of the ancient Shastras, the texts of Veda and Vedic literature. Of course, Maharshi has visited all of these viewpoints of the six systems of philosophy in his various lectures, and has provided a commentary on them that is extraordinarily complete. It takes into account the full range of the nature of the ultimate eternal reality of life, because it is a commentary made from the level of the direct experience of the reality itself. It is Maharshi who has revealed the true meaning and the true practical importance of the ancient Shastras of the Ved and Vedic literature for our time. Maharshi revealed the true significance of Ved and the Vedic literature as the constitution of the universe, the infinite intelligence at the basis of nature, and has brought out the practical programs for anyone to experience the Vedic teachings directly. Under Maharshi's guidance, the Ved and Vedic literature has been discovered as the inner intelligence of the human physiology by MIT-trained physiologist Tony Nader, MD, PhD. The perfect clarity of Maharshi's exposition of the Vedic teachings and the experience he has provided with his practical programs is what has enabled tonight's debate to take place. Maharshi's thinking is what will be presented at every point that each of our debaters will present tonight. And all points will be presented can be directly verified by anyone's deep experience of the ultimate reality through transcendental meditation and yogic flying. Laid out in the format of a debate, tonight's examination of the merits of duality and unity is a celebration of Maharshi's knowledge, Maharshi's systematic and comprehensive presentation of total knowledge, knowledge of the ultimate reality, the source, course, and goal of the whole universe. The debaters will address 8 topics in sequence. They are each allowed a maximum of 5 minutes to speak on each topic. Even though slideshows are not known to have been used in the past, for the benefit of a modern audience accustomed to TV, our speakers have prepared slides and PowerPoints to give visual support to their arguments. At the end of these oral arguments of the two sides, I will attempt to give a summary and synthesis of their arguments, and that will complete our presentation of tonight's full moon. Thank you for coming out tonight. Here we have Dr. Freund, our resident tape librarian, and he will begin on our first topic, the duality of absolute and the relative.
This universe began roughly 10 or 15 billion years ago in a massive explosion called the Big Bang. And the universe that we know contains countless billions of galaxies. And these galaxies each contain hundreds of billions of stars. And our own star, the Sun, is located here in the Milky Way galaxy, which we've recently discovered as a bar galaxy. And to go more smaller distance scale than that. Here on Earth, we have a vast variety of objects of innumerable shapes and sizes made of millions of different chemical constituents. Modern science in the past few hundred years has discovered that objects are made of molecules, and molecules in turn are made of elements, which are the basic building blocks of matter. I'm sure you've all seen the periodic table. We're looking here for the ultimate constituent of creation, so we're on our way here. There are roughly 92 original chemical elements responsible for the vast diversity of molecules and objects on Earth. At first, scientists rejoiced at having found the ultimate, but further investigation at finer and finer distance scales revealed worlds within worlds of finer and finer particles. At each finer and finer distance scale, energy and dynamism was greater and greater. The finest, smallest distance is called the Planck scale. It's about 10 to the minus 47th in size. If we go beyond this, then space becomes undefined and we've really transcended relativity. If we focus on the smaller than the smallest point, we come to an area which is infinite, absolute, and never changing. The universe is huge, on the other hand, with countless billions of galaxies. But if we go to bigger and bigger distance scales, we eventually go beyond the multitude of galaxies to an area which is also undefined, absolute, and infinite. The Upanishads declared this to be the ultimate realization of non-changing truth, that bigger than the biggest and smaller than the smallest is the infinite, the absolute. What is it that is smaller than the smallest and bigger than the biggest? It is the self of man, the soul of man that is infinite, unbounded, and absolute. We can experience this truth of the Upanishads directly by experiencing finer and finer states of the thinking process through the practice of the transcendental meditation technique until we reach the finest level of relativity, and going beyond that, transcending that, we reach a state of pure silence, non-activity, consciousness without any object of experience. On the subjective side of life, there are these three changing states of consciousness, waking, dreaming, and sleeping. And there is this fourth state of consciousness, transcendental consciousness, samadhi, which is beyond all boundaries. This Atma, which is the soul of every human being, is infinite, absolute, unlimited. It is called Shiva in the Upanishads. Shivam Shantam Advaitam Chaturtham Manyante Saatma Savigneha. Shiva is absolute peace, non-dual, said to be the fourth state of consciousness. That is the self. That is worth knowing. It is that that should be studied, realized. It is the self among all the things in this vast creation which should be known. So in this brief survey of the whole field of experience, inside and out, we have located two things: the multiplicity of the changing universe and the simplicity of the self, unbounded, infinite, and absolute. Our conclusion is that life has these two fundamental aspects or constituents. In the Upanishad, it says, life has two forms, manifest and unmanifest, ever-changing and unchanging, limited and infinite, defined and undefined. There is absolute and there is relative. These are two irreducible fundamental values. Duality is fundamental. Duality is the ultimate realization of intellectual analysis. Absolute and relative is the nature of the ultimate reality. Life is fundamentally dual. Thank you.
So we have had our powerful first argument given by the defender of view of duality, Dr. Peter Freund, our resident, he's actually also an assistant professor of Marshi Vedic science here at MUM, as well as in the tape library. He has created the largest collection of Vedic literature available in the world online at mum.edu/Vedic Reserve. And now defending to counter this argument, we have defending the side of unity of the universe, world champion yogic flyer and director of invincible defense technology for the Ministry of Defense of the Global Country of World Peace, Dimitrios Karasis.
Thank you, Dr. Freund. It was a good attempt, but... Well, I have to speak for 5 minutes, but there's actually a one-sentence argument that could reply to this whole argument. You gave it very eloquently, but even quantum physics has discovered that the equation that describes the unified field, the Lagrangian, the unified field, is the same equation that also describes the far reaches of the universe, the structure of the far reaches of the universe, and the movement of all the galaxies. Same equation. So that could be the answer to that. Same thing, the absolute and the far reaches of the universe. But we can go a little deeper. Dr. Freund beautifully mentioned the ancient quote from the Upanishads, Shivam Shantam Advaitam Chaturtham Manyante Sa Atma Sa Vijneya. So that state is peaceful, blissful, and undivided. That's how it's described. And it's undivided. And every single person in this room knows that when we want knowledge of the ultimate reality, then we go to that state, to the undivided state. So when we want knowledge of what the ultimate reality is, we go to the undivided state. This in itself means that reality is undivided. But also the Sanskrit word for truth, which is what we're looking for in this debate, truth. The Sanskrit word for truth is satyam. And what does satyam mean? It means that which never changes. That is one reality that never changes. And everybody in this room knows that it's this undivided state that is never changing. We learned that from the beginning of our practice of transcendental meditation. So it's not a major subject of debate. And the Bhagavad Gita describes this never-changing state as the dweller in the body, which can't be burned, it can't be wetted, it's invincible. Nothing can do anything to that. And that reality is described in the Bhagavad Gita as omnipresent, omnipresent. And how do we get to that reality? We practice yoga. It's yoga that after Lord Krishna teaches the nature of that reality intellectually to Arjuna, then he teaches that he has to practice yoga and settle the activity of the mind to the state that is completely settled. It has no activity. Yoga citta vritti nirotaha is how this state is described. The activity of the mind settles completely, and that is the state of yoga. That is where we go when we want to find the ultimate reality. And what does the Vedic literature say about that state? It says, samatvan yoga uchyate. Balance of mind is what this state of yoga is. So we definitely want a balanced perspective on the nature of the ultimate reality. So when we want balance, we go to the unified state of yoga. And then what we experienced is, it was in Dr. Freund's very argument, that anoraniyan mahatomahiyan, what is smaller than the smallest is also bigger than the biggest. That is the ultimate realization that is said to emerge from this state of yoga. So with this reply that I'm starting with is points that everybody knows, so it's very clear our answer to this debate, even though it was very eloquently stated, and Dr. Freund is a very great professor of Maharshi Vedic Science. Jai Gurudev.
now we want to go deeper into this understanding of the dual nature of reality. In the history of world literature, there is one man who had supreme insight into this dual nature of reality, and by systematically analyzing the whole field of experience, he proved the dual nature of reality with incontrovertible clarity. A work for the ages, a beacon of truth for all time, Jaimini's Karma Mimamsa Sutra is one of the six systems of Indian philosophy. Although in the West we think of each Western philosopher as embodying a particular cultural viewpoint at a particular time and then being superseded by subsequent philosophers, in the Vedic tradition, the philosophical systems are absolutely fundamental and true for all time, valid for all men in all places. Jaimini, interestingly, was a child of the great sage Vyasa, the compiler of the four Vedas and author of the Mahabharata. Jaimini lived about 5,000 years ago, but his exposition is valid today and completely authoritative. And so we'll unpack his approach to analyzing the whole field of life. What is the fundamental unit of creation? What are the ultimate constituents? What are the building blocks of which life is made? When we analyze experience, what do we find as irreducible, ultimate, simple, the supreme value of analysis? This sounds like a familiar question, and we've already followed the analysis in Western science, which started with the positing of atoms by Democritus and has evolved to the current zoo of fine particles with superstrings at the basis. Western science proceeded by excluding the subject or knower from investigation. Jaimini, on the other hand, did not exclude the knower. He did not exclude subjectivity because subjectivity is an essential and irreducible part of our experience of the universe. The atom, for Jaimini, the irreducible unit of the whole creation, is called an impulse. The impulse is a package which contains both subject and object and the relationship which binds them together. There are innumerable objects in creation and innumerable knowers, and there are manifold ways that the knowers can interact with the objects. The fundamental irreducible unit of creation, according to Jaimini, is this impulse of action. There is an actor, an action, and a fruit of action, or we can say a knower, a process of knowing, and a known. In order to connect Jaimini's analysis with the whole field of Veda, we call these three irreducible components Rishi, Devata, and Chandas. An impulse of action is an impulse of Rishi, Devata, and Chandas. Rishi is knower, Devata is the process of knowing, and Chandas is the known. An impulse of action, the basic constituent of the whole creation, is an impulse of Rishi, Devata, and Chandas, an impulse of knower, process of knowing, and known. The coming together of the knower and the known through the process of knowing gives rise to what we call knowledge. The universe is made up of impulses of knowledge, impulses of natural law in motion. The impulse of action is fundamentally an impulse of knowledge. There is order in creation. Everything in the universe functions according to laws of nature, and the fundamental unit of creation, according to Jaimini, is the impulse of natural law, the package of natural law, the impulses of knowledge. The coming together of the knower, the process of knowing, and the known. The duality of knower and known, actor and fruit of action, is the fundamental and irreducible basis of the whole creation. Life is fundamentally dual in nature. Duality is the ultimate realization of intellectual analysis.
Thank you, Dr. Freund. Now you have gone much deeper, and this is more satisfying, but still we will find a more deeper view of the ultimate reality. He has very eloquently described, it's true that first this state of yoga, the state of when we go into ourself and we settle the activity of the mind, at first is experienced as just unified silence, no change, no diversity in it, just unified silence. But then Dr. Freund here is bringing out a more advanced perspective in which that silence is experienced as having impulses of activity inside it, a knower, a known, and the process of knowing inside it, creating impulses of activity, infinite values of the knower, the known, and the process of knowing, all inside that silence. That's a more advanced level of experience. So diversity inside the absolute state of yoga itself. But when we want true knowledge, then we have to consider the summation of all these values of knower, knowing, and known inside the absolute. So the knower being the sum total of all possible knowers, the infinite state of the absolute itself, infinite state. And Lord Krishna presents that in the entire Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna when he's teaching him about the ultimate reality. Pasya me yoga maisvaram, he tells him, which means, behold the richness of the full value of my yoga, myself, which is Sanhita. Sanhita is the union, the togetherness of the knower, known, and known in their full value. Full value of the knower, the infinite absolute itself. Full value of the known, the infinite absolute itself. Full value of knowing, the process through which these two meet, is the infinite absolute itself. So it's just one wholeness reverberating. And when we want total knowledge, we have to go to that state, because that state knows total knowledge. It knows how to create even everything. And Krishna, being the personification of that infinity, explains to Arjuna how the universe is created. Curving back upon my own nature, I create again and again. And creation and the organization and administration of creation are a simple, natural phenomenon on the basis of my sanhita, on the basis of my self-referral consciousness, that together, self-referral consciousness, togetherness of the knower and what the knower is knowing. And it is said in the Vedic literature that we can know one state, that sanhita state, we can know that state. There's one more quote. Under my presidency, all of nature creates both the moving and the unmoving. Through that sanhita value, everything is created. And it is said in the Vedic literature that we can know one state by knowing which everything can become known to us. And that is the state of the ultimate reality, everything, when everything is known. And that is the state of the absolute, the singularity of yoga or sanhita. And when we have total knowledge through the culturing of that state, even far, far away, we see the indweller of the house, the unchanging indweller of the house, being lively, reverberating everywhere, even in the far reaches of the universe. So this activity inside the absolute should really be understood as the absolute itself playing with itself, moving within itself. So I think that is a clear answer that shows us, you know, brings out also the full value of Dr. Freund's argument, because the full value of Dr. Freund's argument is in the value of unity, togetherness. Thank you.
Complete self-sufficiency, where one is complete, infinite, unlimited totality, and one is alone. One is all that there is. This completely unified and integrated state of consciousness is called Kaivalya by Patanjali, and it's the goal of yoga. The fourth chapter was dealing with that in the Yoga Darshanam. So Patanjali describes life in unity as singularity. Jaimini's entire philosophy of Karma Mimamsa should be seen as a response to this culminating achievement of Patanjali. Jaimini says in response, as if he were debating with Patanjali, "You say consciousness is silent, but I see in your silence impulses of action making up the detailed fabrics of pure wakefulness." Jaimini, as if took a microscope to look at the very fine structure of the Kaivalya of Patanjali, and he found that it was not silent, but rather the silence itself was made up of the dynamism of perfectly matched opposite values whose perfectly balanced activity summed together to create silence. Deep within Patanjali's silence, there is a fabric or structure to consciousness which is upholding the experience of silence. What is there in the structure of consciousness? What is consciousness made of? There is a saying that desire and knowledge are the dharma of all conscious beings. Jaimini is studying this dharma, the inherent call to action of all conscious beings. Jaimini sees the whole silent ocean of consciousness as a sea of impulses. Each impulse is a stirring of the whole field of consciousness in a desire, and each impulse is fundamentally an expression of knowledge. Consciousness is seething with impulses of knowledge. The sum total of all the impulses of knowledge is pure knowingness. Pure consciousness is a state of pure knowingness, and for Jaimini, consciousness is quite literally the home of all knowledge. The unbounded, pure singularity of the self being realized as the home of all knowledge, completely lively with all the impulses of knowledge, is the goal of Jaimini's Karma Mimamsa system. There is action in the field of pure consciousness, in the oneness of samadhi, because there is knowingness. Now, Jaimini's impulses of action, which make up the field of pure knowingness, are impulses of knower, process of knowing and known, the relationship of the knower and the known in the process of perception and cognition is the objective structure of the transcendent. Now we have a picture of a sea of impulses, and each impulse as an impulse or quantum of knowingness. Each impulse is an impulse of knowledge, and altogether make up the singularity of Patanjali's Kaivalya. They represent the deep structure of Kaivalya. Jaimini says further that the impulses of knowledge are the impulses of the Veda and Vedic literature. This is Jaimini's perception, that the knowingness of the transcendent is made up of impulses of knowledge, and that these impulses are already available to us in the cognitions of the Vedas and the Vedic literature. This remarkable cognition of eternal truth is the foundation of a complete and perfect science of life. This cognition is the origin of Maharishi Vedic science. So Jaimini concludes that the homogeneous wholeness, the unified field in which all the Vedas are concentrated, is called Purusha. This is the self of man, and this is simply the experience of one's own consciousness. Jaimini is analyzing Patanjali's transcendent with greater detail, and he comes to this new conclusion. The new concept of Kaivalya that is being brought forward is that the fabrics of complete knowledge that structure the awareness of the fully realized knower in the state of the Jaimini Kaivalya are completely identical in form and content to that which is found in the total range of Vedic literature taken together. Innumerable impulses of knowing, impulses of knower, process of knowing and known, all the impulses of Ved and Vedic literature make up the field of pure knowingness, the objective structure of the transcendental being. This is the objective structure of that same pure consciousness that we have been experiencing through the practice of transcendental meditation. Duality is at the basis of this experience of the unified, integrated state of awareness. Duality is more fundamental than unity. Jainmani helps us see that duality is the ultimate reality. Thank you.
So Dr. Freund takes the discussion to yet another level, it seems, because he's telling us that now that silence itself is, these impulses of activity are what makes up the silence, and the structure of that silence are the impulses of activity. And without these impulses of activity, how would we have this silence? So this is the necessary structure of the silence, is the activity, he tells us. So in order to reply to this argument, this is so strong that we will have to refer to the text of Jaimini itself that he refers to. Jaimini, the ultimate exponent of activity, of dynamism, of power in the transcendent, is Karma Mimamsa, his text. And but what does he say in his own text? That in the structure of pure knowledge, which is what we're discussing now, pure knowledge, complete knowledge of the ultimate reality, there's no duality. So what's the topic of our debate? Unity and duality. No duality. But Jaimini says, this is the very text that was referenced now, in accordance with the unity of structure that has been described, the unity of structure is the movement of that wholeness within itself. The structure that appears to be as activity is just the movement of wholeness within itself. But there's two more. These are just examples from Jaimini's work, the ultimate exponent of activity. And he's correct that there's activity in the transcendent, in the advanced experience. There's no doubt about that. But pure intelligence, or the nature of life, we know that pure intelligence is the nature of life from our early days of study of the science of creative intelligence. The wholeness of unbounded awareness is the fabric of pure intelligence. So the fabric of that pure intelligence is wholeness. As structured in unbounded awareness, there is the playing about of the liveliness of Sanhita in the unmanifest. So what may appear to be a knower, a process of knowing, and a known, is just this Sanhita. These are the, what it appears as movement, is just the entirety of the absolute moving. So it's the entirety of the absolute. It never becomes fragmented. It never really becomes active, because it's a non-changing state that moves always within itself. And we have one more quote, I think, that adds that it's the spurring of that unbounded awareness, the movement, as we've been saying, the activity of that unbounded awareness itself enlivens all the laws of nature. And this was another very strong argument that Dr. Freund made, that this is Maharshi Vedic science. We have Maharshi Vedic science because of the diversity in the transcendent, of the diversity of knowledge in the transcendent. So there must be something fundamental to activity, he was saying. But what is that which creates, what which enlivens this totality of the knowledge of all the laws of nature, all the processes of nature? What is that which enlivens that? It's the spurring, the movement of the unbounded awareness itself. So I think that should be enough. If we want to have total knowledge, we have to go to the totality of all the laws of nature, not fragmented laws of nature here and there. And this is not even what Vedic science is or Veda in the Vedic literature, but it's the totality of all the laws of nature taken together. And this is the movement of Sanhita itself, the play of Sanhita itself. So I think that should be a clear answer.
Western science discovered the origin of the universe in the Big Bang. We mentioned that at the very outset. The seers of Maharshi Vedic science see a history of innumerable universes arising, expanding, and then collapsing one after the other in the gap between creations, which is called pralaya. Now the question arises, was the nothingness from which the universe arose a state of pure singularity, or was it fundamentally dual in nature? When there's no object whatsoever in creation, when there's only vacuum before the Big Bang, is there duality or is there only pure singularity? Let's listen to the description in Varuna Puran of what was going on in the vacuum, the pure nothingness that remains in the gap between creations. Varuna said, "When the great Kali age comes to an end at the time of universal dissolution, Mother Divine and all the gods become mere impulses of speech reverberating in the infinite eternal silence of Lord Shiva. The pure silence of eternal being pulsates with the creative principle, Mahat. Having let go all physical manifestation, Mother Divine, whose body is the universe, is reduced to mere impulse. At that time, because the universe is in its least excited state, the womb of all the impulses of speech of the Veda is self-existent, established in its own nature. At that time, Mother Divine is the primordial breath or pulsation of totality. The wholeness of the speech of the Veda first expands in the womb, and then the expansion contracts and is let go. Wholeness was lively with the principle of action, oscillating back and forth between the singularity of pure potentiality for dynamism in the administration of the silence of the gap on one hand, and multiple streams of administration of the different channels of potentiality for expression in that silence on the other, between one Ganesha only and many Ganeshas, between the one mandala structure of Ved in which the gaps between the suktas of the first mandal are filled by the suktas of the 10th mandal, and there is one continuum of the flow of knowledge and only one avyakta, one gap, and the 8 prakritis are implicit, and the 10 mandala structure of the Vedic atom in which the 8 prakritis are expressed in mandalas 2 through 9, and each of the 10 mandalas has its own avyakta sukta, its own gap, its own point of administration in silence. Expanding, exposing all its parts like an umbrella unfolding, revealing details as fine and delicate as the hairs on a yak's tail, and thereby characterizing the abstract impulses of pure knowledge as discrete suktas of the mandalas of Rigveda. By this breathing in, the unmanifest wholeness of the universe in its latent state was adorned with exquisite beauty. And then, breathing out, all the impulses of creative intelligence led by Vishnu, the administrator of the universe, and Brahma, the creator of the universe, the Vedic devatas, together with all the rishis, the seers of the riches of the Veda, all together as one mind, proceeded to worship, propitiate, and identify with the spirit of wholeness in the continuum of total natural law, praising him as the one supreme God, the one without a second. Then, at an auspicious moment, having suddenly thought of Mother Divine, he, Lord Shiva, the ultimate, the supreme Lord of all, was immediately filled with great love, fondness, and affection for her. Then, in a flash, creation expanded quickly in all directions, bringing to an end the peaceful oscillation between the two primordial states of eternal flow of natural law. And now, that restful, self-referral state of bliss of the wholeness abiding in its least excited state became the foundation, the center of peace supporting the tremendous dynamism of creation of the universe. Even in the gap between creations, The Veda is there. Pure knowledge is there because knowledge is eternal. And knowledge intrinsically has organizing power. The duality between knowledge and its organizing power continues even in that silence as the Veda breathes, expanding and contracting. The Veda has two aspects, pure knowledge and infinite organizing power, mantra and brahmana. And this duality within the eternal continuum of silence continues even during pralaya, even in the gap between creations. Duality is fundamental. Duality is the ultimate foundation, the structure of pure, unmanifest existence.
So Dr. Freund wants to go deeper and deeper into the nature of reality and examine the fine fabrics of the universe, and he even went to the period before creation, which is an experience where the person can really have. And this is where he had to go to see if there is really duality or unity in the ultimate reality, even before creation, when there's no material object there. And he tells us everything that he said can be summarized by saying that what he said at the end, that it's organizing power is there. These are the devatas he was describing, the laws of nature, organizing power. And there is, he tells us, knowledge and organizing power, and infinite knowledge and infinite organizing power on that level. But a lot of us have been on the Invincible America Assembly, long program, and we won't be tricked by that because we've heard because knowledge is its own organizing power, and science is its own technology. We're not allowed to reference our teacher, but it's very clear here, very familiar to us, that phrase. Science is its own technology, and Gyan Shakti, the power of knowledge, is the same as Kriya Shakti, as the power of action. Or organizing power. Organizing power and knowledge are the same thing, but in order to answer this argument, we will have to explain why knowledge and organizing power are the same thing. One explanation is obvious, it's on the level of common sense, because organizing power has to be on the basis of knowledge of how to organize everything, knowledge of how to act in such a way so that what we want can be accomplished, what we want can be achieved. It all comes down to knowledge, wisdom of how to act or how to think in a way so that everything can be organized for us. What we want can be organized. But the Vedic literature also describes this principle. It says that creation is based on what was there before. Yatha purvam akalpaya. What was there before determines what will come after. So what we will create based on our organizing power is rooted in our knowledge that was there before, in the memory of what was there before. And what was there before? What was there before is described in the Vedic literature as ancient, Puran. Puran means ancient. And ancient, the Vedic literature means these words in a very literal sense. Ancient means always ancient. So it always was ancient. Even in ancient times, it was always ancient. Eternal, absolute, unchanging, Puran. So yatha purvam akalpayat. Creation is based on what was there before, on the wholeness that always was there before. And even in English, there's an expression, nothing is new under the sun. Nothing is new under the sun. And this is reference to that experience of yatha purvam akalpayat. That anything that is created is always there before. But because the Bhagavad Gita we know to be the summary of the entire Vedic literature, this principle is also in the Bhagavad Gita, because Lord Krishna teaches Arjuna that it's not only the absolute that is non-changing, but even the diverse aspect of life is also eternal and non-changing. Non-changing. So there's no, from that level of experience, even the changing aspect of life doesn't change, and we'll see why briefly, because I have about 1.5 minutes left. There never was a time when I was not, nor you, nor anyone, nor these rulers of men, nor there will ever be a time when all of us shall cease to be. And when we get to the very advanced level of experience that many of you must have glimpsed at some point in the Invincible America Assembly, even the relative, what is known in ignorance as relative, is actually the absolute itself. So what we find to be changing, decaying in the common perception is actually never changing and decaying, but the absolute, the ultimate reality, is eternally a field of all possibilities. So all the possible states of an object are there eternally. And it's just that our experience moves from one state of the object to another state, to the other state, to another state, and we see it changing. But really, we are exploring the different possibilities in the absolute. So what happens really is that all there is one unbounded ocean of consciousness in motion. And so even the relative changing aspects of life are that unbounded ocean exploring the infinite possibilities within itself that never change. The infinite possibilities that are always there eternally. So even this organizing power and the knowledge that is there in the absolute are just the possibilities inside the absolute that the absolute knows as its own nature. So Lord Krishna says it, Dr. Freund. So let's see what you have to say now.
So we're ready for this. Pure, absolute, eternal being is the cause of the material universe. We know that pure being is the cause of the universe because of our own experience in TM. We've heard the phrase, water the root to enjoy the fruit, directly experience the non-changing, eternal, infinite aspects of life in order to simultaneously nourish and enrich all aspects of relative existence. The idea that the absolute is causal, that it gives rise to the relative, is a daily part of our experience of the practice of transcendental meditation. It's why we practice TM, for the benefits and activity. Let's look more deeply at this idea of causality. When we analyze the transcendental being as made up of Veda and Vedic literature, then we're analyzing the root cause of existence. Just as many spreading roots of a tree are the foundation for the multitude of branches of the tree, duality in the root, in the nature of the absolute, is the cause of expression of duality in manifest creation. Now we're going to go back to this Varuna Puran. With regard to the faint stirring of activity within the wholeness of eternal being was divided into two kinds of impulses or tendencies. Here, on close inspection, was this stirring of desire to create. And there, from a broader perspective, was that complete self-referral Shiva quality of the silent wholeness, desiring not to move, not to create. So Jaimini says that of the impulses of action in self-referral performance at the fundamental level of creation, there are those which are most basic, giving the structure to the field itself. These, he calls them, poo impulses, are integral components of the unmanifest field because of these impulses being the integral structural components of the field. So there's a hierarchy of impulses in the absolute, and in the, there are impulses which have no connection with anything outside, but are completely dedicated to maintaining and preserving the integrity of unity, the togetherness of wholeness, and we call these impulses which uphold the silent, unmoving quality of absolute, the poo impulses, and there are impulses at the fundamental level of creation by which the fabric of the self is structured as the sprouting of the unmanifest into the field of activity. through them, the mechanics of evolution and the process of creation may be apprehended because of the process of manifestation being dependent on the stirring of the impulses of the unmanifest. These are the pra-impulses. These two kinds of impulses within the eternal unity of being in the unmanifest, in the unfoldment of being in the process of creation, give rise to Purusha and Prakriti, Shiva and Mother Divine, the subjective and objective phases or poles of manifest creation. Just as the integrated state of wholeness of being in the unmanifest, there are, in that integrated state, there are these two kinds of impulses. There is this innate duality. So also, in the expressed manifest creation, we see this same phenomenon. Among human beings, we find these same two basic tendencies. There are people who have no concern for anything outside. They are only concerned with maintaining the integrity of wholeness. These are monks and nuns who dedicate their lives to directly experiencing and nourishing the transcendental wholeness of life and maintaining coherence in the collective consciousness of society. And there are people who are dedicated to the expansion of creative intelligence in society, expressing fullness of life in the stream of individual existence. Pu and pra impulses on the level of the absolute being, on the level of the cause, give rise to two kinds of people on the level of the effect in manifest creation, monks and householders. Duality on the level of the cause gives rise to duality on the level of the effect. This demonstrates that duality is indeed the fundamental reality. It is the ultimate cause of the whole creation.
So Dr. Freund brings yet another level of depth to the discussion, and this time it's really deeper than all the previous arguments, I think. Now, the nature of the absolute, we all agree that it's silent and that it also has dynamism in it, but he says there's two aspects to its nature, this pu aspect, purusha, and the prakriti aspect, the ever-moving, ever-creative aspect. And in order to answer that, and he traces that all the way to the manifestation of that into the society and how this expresses as two different kinds of people, householders and recluses. So it's a very complete and clear logic. So in order to reply to that, since the absolute has been shown to have two aspects to it, Purusha and Prakriti, and we agree on that, we will have to go to yet another level, and that's a little overwhelming, but we have been forced to bring that out by the greatness of the arguments of Dr. Freund. There is a reality described in the Vedic texts and known also in direct experience by those who have deep experience of transcendental meditation and yogic flying. There's a reality that is greater not only than the changing level of life, but also than the ever-changing. And this is revealed to Krishna, for example, this is revealed to Arjuna by Krishna, for example, in the 11th and 15th chapters of the Bhagavad Gita. And this reality is described as asmat ksharamatito hamakshara dapichotamaha atosmi loke vede cha pratitav purushottamaha. As I surpass the perishable and am higher even than the imperishable, absolute, I am celebrated as Purushottama in the world and in the Veda. So even that word, Purushottama, shows us something of its value as the supreme knower. That reality is described not only as the author of Vedanta, and Vedanta means the end of Veda, as we know, the goal of total knowledge, the goal of all knowledge. That reality, Purushottama, is described in the Bhagavad Gita as the author of Vedanta, but also the knower of the full value of all the Vedas. And Dr. Freund has been quoting from the Vedas, but this is the knower of the full value of all the Vedas, something greater even than the absolute itself. So what happens in the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is Arjuna He's so completely enthralled with the teaching of Krishna. He's completely convinced that Krishna is the knower of reality and what he's teaching is absolute truth. So he's asking, Arjuna is asking Krishna to reveal to him his true form. Out of the great reverence for Krishna, Arjuna wants to see Krishna's true form. He asks him to show him Purushottama, his true form. And what happens is that what Krishna shows him is a reality that is described as, that has a light brighter than 1,000 suns. That is what he shows him. And if we consider that every point in creation, in unity consciousness, is experienced as having the absolute in it, and the absolute, as we found, has two aspects, infinitely silent, infinitely active, Purusha, Prakriti. That is in every grain of creation, infinity in every grain of creation, of silence and activity. Now, if we take the sum total, the congregate, of all the points of infinite silence and infinite dynamism in the whole creation, if we take them all together, that is Purushottama, the ruler of the universe, the sum total even of all the absolute values, something greater than the absolute values in every grain of creation, Purushottama. That's. And when that reality is experienced, then what happens is it's experienced as omnipresent. So even that Purushottama, greater than the absolute, is omnipresent. And it's one reality on all levels of creation. This is the sum total of all the devatas. Sum total, and devatas we heard described in one of the previous arguments. Sum total of all the devatas. Sum total of all levels of creation. All worlds, all individuals. The sum total of all the siddhas. All the siddhas who have mastered the siddhis, the sum total of them all is this Purushottama. And as far as the cause, so that should be enough for that, but as far as the cause and the effect, when the cause of the relative is described as the absolute, the whole purpose of our Team City program is to trace the desire to create something to the outcome of the desire, and to experience a continuum of awareness that has been described to us, that a continuum of awareness is the goal, that from the inception of the desire to its materialization, we want to see no gap. The same intention is becoming the result. It's not becoming, it's the same result itself. That is the ultimate level of experience. So that is the unity level of experience, where the cause is the effect itself. It's no longer a cause that creates something. It contains in it the effect. We want to see the effect of the sutra inside the sutra itself. That is the goal of the TMCD program. So that is unity consciousness. That is the one reality of Purushottama. It's one reality that rules its own expressions. It's not variety. One reality that rules its own expressions, Purushottama.
After this glorious discussion of the teachings of Krishna, I want to go in the opposite direction. There was a great physicist who actually visited this campus at one time. His name was Eugene Wigner, and he located what is really the meeting point between quantum field theory and ancient Vedic science when he demonstrated that it is attention which collapses the abstract wave function to give rise to an observable classical particle. Have people heard of this idea of the collapse of the wave function? I think everyone is familiar with this. This quality of attention which collapses the wave function is precisely what we mean by the process of knowing. In the process of knowing, the abstract infinite is made concrete and manifest, defined, and measurable. Modern science says attention. Vedic science says that it is the process of knowing, the devata, which is responsible for the collapse of the wave function. The collapsing of the unboundedness of the wave function of the object to a point is the activity of the devata value. In both cases, in modern science and ancient Vedic science, the result of the attention of the observer is that the knowledge of the object comes to sit in the consciousness of the knower. The attention going out collapses the abstract wave function and brings back the knowledge of the object to the subject or knower. The devata connects the rishi with the object, with the chandas. There are two things here. There is the abstract wave function, and there is the localized point. The two are connected together by devata. Every devata is an impulse of natural law. There are innumerable devatas, and altogether constitute the objective structure of the field of consciousness, transcendental being. The reverberation between infinity and point is the virtual fluctuation of knower, process of knowing, and known in the unmanifest. Infinity becomes point, and point becomes infinity. These two opposite values are the extreme poles of one and the same thing. It is the nature of being to reverberate between abstract, unmanifest infinity, the universal aspect of pure intelligence, and manifest point, particulate structure, the individual expression of intelligence. There is an infinite spin between knower, process of knowing and known, between infinity and its point, reverberating back and forth eternally. And this is the dynamism lively at every point in creation. Each point is always intimately connected with its own source in universal intelligence. There is actually no difference between the wholeness of natural law and its expressed impulse, its point. Both should be understood to be the same. There is complete reciprocity between the ocean of consciousness and its wave. The point is an expression of the whole. In religious language, we say that man is created in the image of God, or in the language of Vedic science, yata pinde tata brahmande. As is the body, so is the universe. The macrocosm, the universal field of total natural law, is expressed in its completeness in the point, in the microcosm. It is one and the same natural law lively in the universe as a whole and in each individual point value expression in the universe. If the total value of pure intelligence contains within its structure the Veda and all the 40 branches of Vedic literature, as we've seen in our previous discussions, then that same value of total intelligence of natural law must be imbibed in its point value of expression in the human nervous system. And Dr. Tony Nader has discovered that all the 40 branches of Vedic literature and all the Vedic devatas are structured in human physiology. Human physiology is a perfect microcosm, the perfect model of universal intelligence. Jaimini confirms this connection between the ocean and its wave, between cosmic intelligence and its expression in human physiology. There is complete reciprocity between the ocean of consciousness and its wave. The duality between infinity and point is the basis for the experience of higher states of consciousness. The individual can live totality in his daily life because fundamentally he is structured in the total value of natural law. All the Vedas, all the Vedic literature, all the devatas are structured in his physiology. The tiny, insignificant physiological structure of the human being is the repository of the total intelligence that structures the universe. And one can live that, move about with that holistic awareness of totality of existence. The reverberation between infinity and point within one's own consciousness is the dynamism of total natural law, the ruler of the universe. The duality of infinity and point is the fundamental constituent of the experience of unity. The relationship between infinity and its own point helps us see that duality is the ultimate reality. Duality is the nature of life. Duality is fundamental.
I think, Dr. Freund, at the close to the beginning of your argument, I think you mentioned something to the effect of that infinity and point are two poles of the exact same thing. Two poles of the exact same thing. So it's impossible to speak about duality in a knowledgeable way, and you're speaking about it in a very knowledgeable way. It's impossible to speak about it in a knowledgeable way without bringing out the unity element. What did he say? Two poles of the exact same thing, something like that. So, first of all, I think he should be congratulated, because after this vision of Purushottama, it would be hard. I would have trouble maintaining my focus, but this is, it's very great that he managed to, so in a, such a focused way, he managed to bring out very logically his point, so we have to congratulate him on that. But that reality of Purushottama perhaps wasn't completely comprehended, because that argument wouldn't have come up if it was completely comprehended, because Purushottama sees every point in the universe as totality itself, as the absolute value itself. And that point value is just this Prakriti value, which Prakriti means nature. Is the nature of the Purusha value of every point of creation. And this is described in Vedanta by Purushottama. As we saw, Purushottama is the author of Vedanta. And every sutra of Vedanta is described as containing the whole Purushottama. It's characterized by Purushottama completely. So what does this Vedanta say? There are many sayings that are in that, that explain that there is nothing else in the universe, nothing else in the universe other than the unmanifest. So when we talk about manifest points, this is very interesting, because neha na nasti kinchana is one famous saying from the Upanishads. Manifest diversity is all unmanifest. There is nothing else. And what does that mean? That it contains Purusha and Prakriti in it. It contains Purusha. And it contains also Purushottam. Purushottam is, by the way, Param Purusha and Param Prakriti, both together. Param Purusha, transcendental value of Purusha. Even beyond the individual value of Purusha that we see as the unchanging maintainer of the activity and growth of individual points in creation, this is beyond that Param Purusha, the transcendental, completely transcendental value of any object in creation, and Param Prakriti. This is not even the manifest Prakriti. This is Para Prakriti. It's the transcendental Prakriti. It has not even emerged yet. It's a concept in the unbounded ocean of Purusha. And on that note, it is also said that Brahma Satyan Jagan Mithya Jivo Brahmaiva Na Paraha. Only Brahman, only that unified reality of Purushottam. Purushottam is the same as Brahm. Same as Brahm. The sum total of everything in the universe. The sum is more than, whole is more than the sum of its parts. So this is more than anything. Brahm is real, and the world only appears to be real. Myself, anyone's self, is totality and nothing else. And we know all these expressions, everybody knows, aham brahmasmi. I am totality. I, myself, is everything. And tattvamasi, thou art that unchanging totality, undivided. Sarvam kaluidam brahm. Everything is brahm. Everything, all points. Sarvam kaluidam brahm. How could it be more clear? And ananda dhyeva, kalvimani bhutani jayante, anandena jatani jivanti, anandam prayantyapisam visanti. Out of bliss, these beings are born, because Brahm is obviously bliss. For Arjuna, Purushottam was so much bliss that he could hardly stand the experience, and he asked Lord Krishna to to not to take that experience away, because he couldn't, it was too much. Out of bliss, these beings are born. In bliss, they are sustained. And to bliss they go and merge again. Out of bliss these points values are born, and to bliss they are in bliss they are sustained, and to that they return again. All the point values. So all the point values. It's good that, you know, it's unity. Sorry, Dr. Freund, but at least it's bliss.
So thank you. Let's see now what you can say after this. It will be interesting.
There was a mention just made of the everything in the universe being basically illusion was the idea, that it wasn't, it was actually absolute. And we want to look momentarily, we're not going to give a full treatment of this, implicit cause and non-implicit cause and parinamvad and vivartvad could keep us busy for many days of continuous debate. We want to give kind of a sketch of the implicit cause and non-implicit cause. The idea of the absolute being the cause of the relative, and the absolute being the cause means that the absolute goes through a series of transformations, as was described in that discussion of the pralaya, where there was all kinds of, they called it symmetry breaking, and suddenly the whole creation came up out of that, out of transformations of that original silence. So the idea that transformations of pure being, various levels and levels, one layer upon the other, can build up and create the manifest structure of existence, can create atoms and molecules and consciousness and all these things through transformation. This is what's called parinambad. And this is basically the basis of modern science. We analyze to look at the cause. We analyze, go deeper into a phenomenon with the understanding that we're going to find what was there at the outset that created that phenomenon. If we see the hoof print of a deer in some mud, we infer that that transformation was brought about by a cause, and that cause was a deer stepped there sometime before when the ground was moist. And in all areas of our lives and in all areas of science, this idea of transformation being the basis of the expression of natural law, it's very basic. Parinam vad is what it's called. Transformation giving rise to a new result. Transformation is a cause. It's completely normal and common sense. And it's also described in the Upanishads. Here are the two, the implicit cause and the non-implicit cause. And then tat srishtva tadeva anupravishat. Having created creation, the creator entered into it. That means the creator is there in the created product. It's not separate from him. He's transformed himself into the creation. It's not a separate thing. Now, what could be different than that? What could be opposite than that? Before we do that, we should mention that Karma Mimamsa proposed the examination of the means, which means completely an analysis of this kind of parinamvad type of analysis. He's going into how does the expressed object come out of the transformations of the unmanifest? How do the action impulses give rise to manifest creation? That's his whole field of study, parinamvad. Now, the non-implicit cause is when no amount of analysis of the effect will bring you to the cause. And the classic example of this is the snake and the string. In poor light, a string is seen, and someone says, "Oh my God, it's a snake!" And there is no snake. And no matter how you analyze the situation, how long you study it from so many different directions, The snake was never there. It's illusion. So this is a different kind of logic when one realizes that something is illusion. Now, this kind of vibhartavad is there in the analysis of the process of creation, which my colleague here has described, where you have a series of transformations, but what is observed in that series of transformations as the flavor is being expressed in the experience of the TM City program. In this process of transformation, one is aware of what's not changing. The unmanifest is the same at every step. The unmanifest is the same. It's the unmanifest being seen in a different light, being expressed somehow differently, but remaining the same. And so through that whole process, the unmanifest doesn't actually become manifest. It maintains its status as being unmanifest. And so the expressed, changed result is actually secondary or illusory, and the non-change is the underlying reality. And this is the logic of the Vibhartavad, where there isn't actually a transformation. It's just unchanging value. And we wanted to bring out the value of this thinking, where this thinking, this kind of thinking is useful, besides in unity consciousness, where it's definitely the prevailing logic. But even before that, this is the principle of cause of disease that occurs in Charak. In Charak, he says that pragyaparad, mistaken intellect, is the cause of all disease. Now, if a malaria mosquito bites someone and he gets malaria, then we would say that the mosquito was the cause of the disease. But Charak has analyzed that the human nervous system is based fundamentally on this eternal aspect of the self. It's a reflection of the eternal structure of natural law. It's quite invincible. It's not subject to disease, not subject to suffering and disease and all these other problems. It's invincible. But what happens is that the nervous system isn't being used properly. The individual uses his mechanics of perception in such a way that he forgets the wholeness value and just sees the point value. And having lost that unboundedness, then his intellect is mistaken. He sees a point value instead of seeing the wholeness. This is what's called the mistaken intellect. And so this loss of that wholeness is the cause of disease. And it's a whole different angle of thinking. That's Vibhartavad. Another example that is very familiar is the Maharshi effect. And the Maharshi effect is mysterious. What it's claiming is that crime is caused by lack of coherence in collective consciousness. And so when we raise the collective consciousness of society, then crime goes down. We don't need to put a policeman on every corner in order to discourage people from committing crimes or arresting them as soon as they do. So it's a different kind of logic than the Parinambad. So Parinambad and Vibhartavad are two opposite viewpoints on the nature of the ultimate cause. So this is another demonstration. This is another demonstration of duality, two kinds of causes. Thank you.
We all noticed how quickly he turned back when he went to the other slide. So we don't need to comment on that. He obviously didn't want people to see that the ultimate nature of every transformation and every cause and every effect is fullness, which
by undergoing transformation just moves within itself and there's no transformation there. You just turn back quickly. But we'll analyze that and we'll see that in unity consciousness, these two different perspectives on reality are just two different aspects of the same one experience of unity. Even when you speak about the Maharshi effect or perfect health, Dr. Freund, you recognize that there is still a cause. If a person has perfect health, then we know that the cause was there, that the person has developed the full value of consciousness. So the cause is always there. And if all that cause-effect relationship is there, and it does not deny the never-changing nature of the Absolute. So Parinamvad does not deny the nature of Vivartvad, and we'll just analyze that. And it's very simple to look at that. Do we have that slide? Yes, we have it. So this is the analysis of the word Vivart, which is that which Dr. Freund claims is no transformation, no, hardly any cause and effect relationship. It's all sameness. It's all sameness. Does it look like all sameness? Va means alternative, or alternate. Devata means flow or transformation, movement. So it's something alternative is created. But there's at the same time a continuous flow. So it's that continuous flow that undergoes changes within itself. It's really the movement of wholeness within itself. This is what is contained in the word Vivart. And we see that there is alternative. There's something alternative that is there. Even on the level of the Absolute, we know, even on the level of unity consciousness, one knows, as we know, that even the Vedic literature undergoes some development. It's not non-changing and completely... It is non-changing in one sense, but it also develops from the as we know, all the different sounds of the Vedic literature come. So there is some transformation, there is some movement. Becomes Agni, Mila, Purohitam, and so on. So there's always movement, always transformation. But this transformation, what makes it Vivartvad, what makes it a continuous flow, what makes it unity consciousness, is that the principle that we mentioned earlier, yatha purvam akalpayat, that every transformation is on the basis of what occurred before. So any transformation is actually wholeness on the move, and this is confirmed, even though Dr. Freund turned back, he doesn't want us to see. This is confirmed. This is how transformation is described. This is how the cause-effect relationship is described in the Vedic literature. Purnamadav purnamidam purnat purnamudachyate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vasishyate. So everything is fullness. The cause is fullness. The result is fullness. From fullness, fullness comes out. And if we take fullness from fullness due to the transformation, what remains on the level of the cause and what remains on the level of the effect is fullness. So in principle, there is always Parinamvad, even in unity consciousness. In principle, there is always transformation, even though the unchanging fullness is always there as the nature of every stage of the transformation. And that we see from the Veda, as we said, Veda unfolds in a certain way. And we see it everywhere. Everywhere we see transformation. Life is ever progressive. Every aspect of it, even the absolute aspect, undergoes movement within itself. And this is the glory, actually, of unity consciousness that is developed with yogic flying, with every hop of yogic flying. Opposite values. Transformation, because we have to be active, we have to be transforming things, we have to be transforming ourselves, but also lack of transformation. Ever non-changing, never-changing state, which is the nature of every state of transformation. This is the nature of every hop in yogic flying. Again, we are not allowed to reference who explained this to us. But this is the reality, and we can confirm it from our own experience. So it's the nature of every hop, Dr. Freund. Transformation is just fullness moving within itself, Brahm, totality. That is the perfection of wholeness. It contains both Parinamvad and Vivartvad. Thank you.
That was very good. That sets us up for the final stroke. There are two things, analysis and synthesis. And Both are necessary steps on the path to knowledge. Through analysis and synthesis, total knowledge is gained. Now, analysis is carried forward by Jaimini in his Karma Mimamsa, and the synthesis is carried forward by Vyas, who wrote the Brahma Sutra. So these are two parts of one path, one program for gaining knowledge: analysis and then synthesis. And synthesis is described in the Brahma Sutra already in the fourth sutra, Tat Tu Samanvayat. Brahman is gained through synthesis. So this whole path development starts with singularity of Patanjali, and then that singularity is analyzed, as we've analyzed it tonight, and we see that that singularity of consciousness is actually made up of innumerable impulses of natural law, the impulses of Veda and Vedic literature. This is the analysis of singularity. And then Vyasa comes along and he synthesizes the singularity and the impulses and gives one holistic vision of total knowledge. So there's a multiplicity of perspectives on reality, but whichever systems the teacher knows, whichever systems the teacher imparts to his students, in which knowledge or by what science the teacher rejoices, every teacher has the universal awareness of the unity of knowledge, comprehending all of the sciences, so that in praising any one system, there is lauding of the togetherness of all of them. And this is the viewpoint that all of the systems actually, it's very interesting, they all praise the Vedanta Sutras, the Brahma Sutras, as the highest teaching. And I wanted to show this. This is from Karma Mimamsa also, as that last sutra was. That is the eternal knowledge of the infinite unbounded reality, because it is the expression in speech of the greatest knowledge, because it completely describes all of the experiences and knowledge relating to the wholeness, Brahman. Now, there is a very interesting relationship between Vyasa and Jaimini, because they're contemporaries, and each of them cited each other in their texts. Their texts apparently were written about the same time, not one before the other, and one of them, they each cite the other about a dozen times. I think I gave the numbers here. 13 citations of Bhadarayana in Karma Mimamsa and 11 citations of Jaimini in the Brahma Sutra. So Jaimini upheld Bhadarayana as the goal, and Vyasa upheld Karma Mimamsa as the path. So the final point that I want to make is that the relationship between Vyasa and his child, Jaimini, highlights the relationship between the master and the disciple. In every generation, knowledge flows from teacher to student, and the student becomes a teacher, and again the knowledge flows to the next generation. The student needs a teacher, and the teacher only becomes a teacher when he has a student. The knowledge doesn't flow through the eternity of time unless both are there. This is demonstrated in the Upanishads, where sometimes the line of teachers of that Upanishad is given, and that's what we're showing here. This is only one of many pages of the line of teachers of Brihadaranyaka. The student always holds the teacher as apart from his own self, as the source of all his wisdom of life. The student knows that without the teacher, he could not have gained this state of enlightenment. He would not be enjoying this eternal state of infinite bliss and fulfillment. Knowledge itself is eternal, always the same truth, but the tradition of complete knowledge flows through time, and in each generation there must be new knowers, to carry on the tradition. Teacher and student, master and disciple, this is the final and ultimate duality, a duality which can never be transcended. As long as man has been here, there have been teachers and students, and this is how knowledge is sustained and flows on through all the millennia of the past and for all the millennia to come. And that is the ultimate and irreducible demonstration of the fundamental nature of duality. Thank you.
So, Dr. Freund, you have brought out two very interesting points. One was the duality of analysis and synthesis, which are the means, by the way, of developing total knowledge, which is Brahm, its unified wholeness, as we'll see. So that was one of your arguments. And your second argument was the duality between teacher and student. But in order to understand both those arguments, we have to understand what is the knowledge that is being conveyed from teacher to student, and what is the knowledge that is being developed through analysis and synthesis. Analysis and synthesis are both fundamental. They are just means of experiencing that wholeness. We analyze and synthesize the ultimate reality in order to experience total knowledge, knowledge of everything. And that is described by the phrase anvaya, vyatirekabhyam, nishprapancham prapanchate. I don't think we have a slide for that. That through analysis and synthesis, the indivisible wholeness of Brahman is realized in one single awareness. So these are just means of experiencing that one unified reality. And even Nyaya, which so in such a detailed way goes into the analysis of what the ultimate reality is, it explains the unified, synthesized aspect of life and the analyzed aspect of life that we can also think of in terms of synthesized value is a non-changing, non-active value, Purusha. And the analyzed, we can call it analyzed value. It's the value where we have looked into the silence and found, analyzed the activity in that silence, Prakriti, the nature of Purusha, the nature of silence. But it sees a third reality, the lamp at the door between those two realities, which witnesses those two realities as what? As its own expressions. And there, I'm sorry for coming back to this overwhelming reality, but this is Purushottama, that word, is the lamp at the door in Nyaya, which unifies both those different perspectives. And that Purushottama is omnipresent in every aspect of analyzed reality and every aspect of the synthesized wholeness. And I think this is simple enough, and we can conclude here. There's a quote after Lord Krishna explains this reality to Arjuna, the same reality that we just described, that wholeness is there, and it includes within it all the analyzed values and all the synthesized values, yes, but as its own nature itself. And when I was coming down from the stage in the previous argument, someone whispered to me that, but there's still two things, it's Parinamvad and Vivartvad. But I think the point should be clear that the Parinamvad is Vivartvad in the state of unity consciousness.